Hello and welcome. Today I am joined by Dr. Jim Kearse, who is a sport and exercise medicine consultant based, well, he's based in the Northwest, but I know him best from his time in Manchester. So Jim, where are you today and welcome?
Thanks for the invite. In Manchester, as you say, in the sun. So I'm doing work at the MIP today in East Manchester. So my week, 3.5 days a week is with the UK Sports Institute, where we're based at the MIP here in Manchester, where I do some work for multi-sport athletes, also as sports medicine lead for the Institute and also athlete health lead, where I lead on respiratory health for the Institute as well.
Great. Yeah, no, I love going to MIP. It's got a real interesting setup there, and I know there's some great people working out of there. So we'll start off with, so doing the introduction, talk to me about your surname, because we were just saying before, I've not come across that surname before. Where's that from?
Yeah, unique one. As I said, so there are lots of Kers, so K-E-R-R-S, but I'm the only, well, I'm not me the only, but I'm the only family that I've seen with like one or two S's, so Scottish heritage. So my dad counts himself as a Scotsman. I would support England at rugby, so I think that probably tells you. I count myself as an Englishman, but yeah, no, so it's an unusual surname. And working in the medical industry, often get it's very rare to get someone who spells my name correctly, I would say. You often see two R's, one S. So it's one of those things. When my wife got married, she said the same thing. It was just like reluctance to take the surname. But yeah, we are where we are.
Then, so where were you from originally then, if your dad's Scottish?
Yeah. Grew up over in Lincolnshire. So over in Lincolnshire, I went to school in Hull and then went to university in Sheffield for medical school. And then we stayed over there for, I did GP training after medical school. So did my GP training over in Rotherham. And then me and my wife got married in 2011, making sure I get the dates right. And then we went to Australia actually and worked in Australia for a year. Doing a mixture of emergency medicine, and that's where I started getting much more involved in sports medicine, and then came back in 2012 and started on the NHS sports medicine training scheme in the northwest of England, and then since then I've been in the northwest.
Right, okay. So like Lincolnshire always just strikes me as like the real middle of, there's so much space there. Is that an accurate reflection of it? It's like sort of the middle of nowhere.
Well, that's a nice way of saying there's not a huge amount going on. Yeah, so it's a beautiful place. Like my family's still over there. So there is, you know, lots of countryside there, lots of farming land, you know. But my predominant association, I would say, was because I went to school in Hull for 10 years. So I used to travel across the Humber Bridge every day, 10 years, and had a good time at school there. Still got quite a few friends that I'm still in touch with from school who have kind of spread all around the world actually and around the UK. So I'd say kind of my association, if someone says like, you know, where are your fondest memories of, you know, childhood growing up, it's probably related to like school life, being in and around Hull, which is a nice city.
It's good. It's got two good universities over there as well. And then so for when you were deciding to get into this field, or what was the pathway for you deciding that you wanted to go into medicine?
Into medicine or sports medicine, like medicine as a...
Well, I suppose medicine in the first instance, just like what was the prompter to get you going in that area?
I think probably interest at school, two main areas. Like one was like a science-based interest. I used to quite like doing science, so like biology, chemistry, etc. And one of those kind of slightly unusual people, I guess, in that regard that tickle my fancy. And then the second thing was I had a genuine interest in people, like, you know, sociable person, just like that side of things. So I liked the idea of doing a job where I was involved in interacting with people and caring for people. So I started getting, you know, as you have to do nowadays, well, back, I mean, 20 odd years ago, it was definitely the case where you had to start getting experience like mid-teens onwards to show commitment to wanting to study medicine at university. So, you know, did placements in GP practice in hospital, and in a care home locally to where I lived, and just you know, seemed that was what interested me, and then went down that route, I guess. And I was kind of fortunate, or I think fortunate. People look at this in different ways, but quite a strong heritage of doctors in the family. Like my dad's GP, retired GP. Mum was a nurse, and then both my grandparents were my grandfathers were doctors as well. So yeah, it's quite a strong heritage of that. So I think that probably influences you a little bit in that regard as well. You know, if you've got some interest in science, you see that you've got people close to you in the family who have had decent careers and decent lives, and you start thinking that's probably something that might be interesting to me. So yeah, mixture of things, I think, leads you down that path rather than one thing.
Yeah. So what are your memories of being like having a mum who's a nurse and a dad who's a doctor?
Honestly, as a kid, was messing around in the GP surgery, because it was in the actually probably a couple of things. Like, one was the advent of mobile phones. So my dad was obviously on call as a GP, and I remember him when he first got a mobile phone, this ginormous thing that was like the size, genuinely the size of a brick, and used to go off. And it was I remember that from childhood. And he used to have this big A4 book that he used to write down calls that he'd had overnight. So that was something that sticks in my mind. And then the other one was, we used to then say, if he was on call on a weekend, it would be like nowadays you do this whole thing where you know, as an on-call GP, you're covering basically like a city, you know, rather than just specifically your surgery. But back in the day when he was a GP and I was young, it was just looking after the patients from your surgery and just being on call for them. So he used to go in weekends and then basically take us in. So I have pretty fond memories of me and my two brothers basically running around this deserted GP surgery while my dad was doing calls and this type of stuff. I don't think you'd be able to get away with that or do it nowadays, but that was life. So yeah, fond memories of this. And I still remember the smells of, like, you know, the disinfectant stuff in like the nursing station or the corridor, and the spectacularly strong smell of coffee that was in the staff room where we used to sit. So yeah, it's like, yeah, it's nice that it's bringing back memories.
It's funny, it's obviously worked on you because you've gone into that field as well. But yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, when you're reflecting on these things, it's like got such vivid memories of kind of bizarre, obscure things.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So then what made you do Sheffield then?
Sheffield was probably the only place that would have me, to be honest with you. Like, I did obviously did my levels, and then I was originally had offers, I think, from King's in London and Sheffield University. And then I think it was like, I can't remember the exact setup, but King's, I think, wanted like certain grades, and Sheffield wanted an A in chemistry, I believe it was. And yeah, ended up that missed out on one of them, but then had to redo chemistry A level. So kind of got finished on in the summer of that year, and then didn't get an A in the chemistry. So then resat it again in the following like December, January time, which is it was unexpected, because I was kind of in my head, I was thinking, oh, I'm going to go to, you know, go down to London, go to university medical school there. And then as a reverse way, I ended up having to do, you know, quite intense load of revision again for like 4 or 5 months to resit just the chemistry, which at the time when you're 18, you know, that's definitely not what you want to be doing with your life. But in hindsight, it's been like unbelievably useful to instill like a, you know, work ethic, I think, in myself, and an internal drive, because you have, you know, have a setback there where you're thinking everything's going to plan and something, you know, goes not to plan at all. And I think it's been a really, you know, important thing in my life as to how it's helped me, you know, as I say, with kind of work ethic and dealing with, you know, a little bit of adversity and when things don't go quite to plan. And it works out well. I did the A-level resit, passed that, got an A. Sheffield said they'd take me. So then I basically had the rest of that year to play with. So I ended up, at the time, my older brother was working, he was working in a hotel in the Alps. So he basically got me a job fairly last minute. And so after I did the resit, I went out and did a ski season in Les Deux Alpes in France from like the January through until April time. And then had a job working on these like big summer events in the UK, which was pretty good fun actually, because they basically found out that I was going to do medicine, and I think assumed that I had some form of intellect. And so they put me in charge of like running these bars and restaurants for like hospitality events in the summer. So it was really good fun. We had that good summer because I was like 18 years old, and we're basically just going around the country working at these like sports events, managing the bars and managing these big hospitality restaurants, and having honestly no idea what I was doing. But again, it was quite a good way of, you know, me as an 18-year-old actually in charge of another group of like 16, 17-year-olds who were all trained waiting staff. and just like again managing people and doing this kind of stuff. So it was good experience that year, and then went to university in Sheffield after that.
I think those things, like you look back at the jobs, and I've had it with a few other people I've had on here, is that those jobs that you kind of see as filler jobs, but they do actually play a massive role in,
No, it's
you know, your
huge.
people skills and development and what you enjoy doing.
Yeah, it was huge, honestly. I look back on that. There was that year or so was, I think, like hugely formative in my life because, you know, I say a bit of adversity with the exam, working hard. Absolutely loved working in the Alps, and then, you know, being into skiing and love kind of going to the mountains ever since then. And then latterly, like the job in the summer was really intense. You know, we were doing like long days. I remember working like the Chelsea Flower Show and the Open Golf, doing like the hospitality stuff in the bar. So you're up at like 5 a.m. like doing all the stocks, and then finishing at like, you know, 10, half 10, 11 o'clock. And then just because it was, you know, at the age, you then go out and have a few beers as a group, get one back up again at five, you know. So a lot of stuff around like hard work and teamwork and working with other people I learned there, I think. But I don't think I would have got anywhere else if I'd just gone straight into med school.
Yeah, no, I think that's really good stuff, and it does play a massive, massive part of it. So then when you get to Sheffield, like, did you have a clear plan? Like, your dad had been a GP, did you have a pathway of what you wanted to do?
Not really, no. No, I mean, for me, looking back at medical school, I obviously learned some stuff, but actually I just really enjoyed the experience. Like, I love being in Sheffield. You know, played a lot of sport, like rugby union in particular. Just had a great time, to be honest with you, in terms of socializing is what I remember. Met my wife, like we were in medical school together. So we got together like start of the second year, so which is obviously a kind of positive memory. And my younger brother was also at Sheffield University at the same time. He was a couple of years younger than me. But he was doing like a law and Spanish degree there as well, and was into the same stuff. So we had quite a few, you know, close friends. So for me, like, if I'm looking back at medical school days, I remember like the socializing and the fun side of things rather than necessarily being too focused on a career. I think that's probably a bit different now. Like, I meet, particularly because in our field, like sports medicine, people seem to be really focused on wanting to do that from, you know, school days a lot of the time. And then they're trying to develop their knowledge of the specialty and experience in the specialty throughout medical school, which was completely different to my experience. Like, I wasn't even on my mind at all. Until I was really doing GP training, I think. So yeah, not through medical school. I didn't really know what I wanted to do, to be honest with you. I came out of towards the end of med school, I did a research project looking into alcoholic liver disease. There was a big alcoholic liver disease gastroenterology and liver surgery unit at the Hallamshire Hospital in Sheffield. And so I did a research project into that towards the end of like med school. And then there was a and now they call F1 job, but a house officer job there at the time that was 4 months GP, 4 months liver medicine, 4 months liver surgery. And because I'd done the research thing, I thought, all right, that's just the job that's made for me. And I did GP as the first thing, my first job outside out of medical school, which was a bit unusual at that stage. Like, most doctors go straight into working in hospital. But the same thing, I worked for this GP in a city, fairly deprived area in Sheffield, and just really like absolutely loved the experience there of working in the surgery. And I'd gone into that thinking I'm going to, you know, cure the world of alcoholic liver disease into that job, and then actually came out of it at the end of that year thinking that's not what I want to do. I want to do general practice. So yeah, that's kind of where it came to. And after that, I was down the route of wanting to do general practice training, which I did after that.
And then, so once you were starting to do placements and so on, like, did that also influence what you wanted to do? So you'd not wanted to go down like the hospital route, but at what point did the sports element become something that you were thinking about?
That came about in GP training. So I did the first 2 years, F1 and F2 as they're called nowadays, and then got onto the GP training scheme in Rotherham. And the guy who was the doctor who was the lead trainer for Rotherham was also the Rotherham Rugby Club doctor at the time. And I remember he was also, because my dad was a kind of GP within the Yorkshire Lincolnshire area, and he was involved in GP training as well, so they knew each other. So I remember having a talk to him about what he was doing. And he said about the Rotherham thing, and I said, oh, that sounds quite interesting, because I was still playing rugby union at the time. And I asked him if I could come down and just observe what happened on a weekend. And I went down to a couple of the matches, And again, really just thought that was, or I couldn't believe that there was somewhat a doctor being paid to do that type of job, to be honest with you, at the time. And so I started looking into it a little bit more, and yeah, seeing what the different opportunities were. And then as I was going through GP training, I realized that I was going to qualify as a GP in my late 20s. And being honest, I couldn't see myself doing just general practice through until potentially pension retirement age at 68. I thought it would be a bit too much, and I wanted to, you know, diversify what I was doing. So I remember distinctly one day driving home from GP practice in Rotherham back to where I lived in Sheffield, and I was driving past the what was then the English Institute of Sports site in Sheffield. And I never really kind of thought about it before. And I just, well, for whatever reason, you know, just turned into the car park and basically walked into the Institute. And I just was like, came up, went to the reception desk, and I said, oh, I've started doing a lot of, I'm the GP trainee, started doing a bit of Rotherham Rugby Club. I didn't know anything about the EIS, you know, what happens here. And then it was, again, a weird sliding doors moment that the doctor who was doing a locum shift that day was a doctor called John Greenwell, who I work with closely still now. And he was there, and he at the time was the Leeds Rhinos doctor. And so I spoke to him for about an hour or so. He gave up an hour of his time and talked through about the specialty. And then after that, I started getting some experience up with John at Leeds, and then started covering some Leeds Rhinos Academy games, which I then did for about the last 12 to 18 months of my GP training in Rotherham. And then, you know, after that, Australia, and after that onto this scheme. So it was one of those weird moments in life where, for whatever reason, just driving home, okay, take the turn off, go and ask the question, can't say why that happened. And that was the probably the one moment that completely changed like what I was doing as a career.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's really interesting. So that work that you were doing with John, was that like, were you getting paid for that, or what's going on with that?
Yeah, so I did initially it was shadowing, you know, experience, just seeing what he did at Leeds. Went to a couple of the training sessions up in Leeds, went to observe him doing a few, covering some of the games for Leeds Tykes, they were called at the time, in rugby union, and also the league games. And then got myself a place on the RFL pitch side trauma course, and then after that was, you know, certified, I guess, to be able to do the job. So then John started putting me on the rota to cover the academy games. So I went through about, it was about maybe two seasons, I think, of doing that before we went to Australia, of getting experience covering the kind of 15, 16s and then under 18s Leeds Rhinos games, which was just a great way to get experience, because I was doing that on my own on the match day. But then if I had anything, you know, really challenging, then again, John was really accessible and available on the end of the phone to talk to about, you know, any problem cases. So it was kind of like a semi-supervised role as well. So yeah, great opportunity.
And then, so was that based at Kirkstall, the joint facility, which was with
I went there a bit, and then there was a place, is it Stanningley, I think it was called, I think that was a place where they used to play the academy games. So yeah, it was great, and they had quite a few of the first team players. The more experienced first team players were actually the academy coaches there as well. So you got to experience a little bit more of starting to work alongside these players who had been professionals, you know, for a long period of time. And I used to watch a lot of rugby leagues. So there were people like Jamie Jones-Buchanan, Rob Burrow, who were the coaches there for the kind of age group sides. And that I thought was just like a great thing as a club there, that they had these players who were like the you know, the big hitters in the first team, were then giving up their time to learn coaching in a, you know, with the academy lads. So, and a really just really good culture and ethos that was running through that club, I would say. I distinctly remember a couple of times where they wouldn't accept any of the players on the age group sides, even if they were like really good players, they wouldn't accept any of them being like above the team. So if one of the lads did a behind the back pass, something simple like this, they were taken off, which was like so stark, you know, that I remember that to this day, you know. And if they were winning, because they were a good team, so if they were winning, you know, a lot, and if there was any showboating, anything like this, the coaches would just take the player off, even if they were the best player. And they had some lads who went on to play in Super League, you know, like Stevie Ward was one who played. I remember watching him as like a 15-year-old, just unbelievable player even then. And then they had John Bateman, who's gone on to play for England and in Australia, Wigan, etc. So there were some really good players coming through at that stage. But strong focus on like ethos, culture, and just being part of a team rather than being a superstar player.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I met Jamie Jones Buchanan recently because he's got, I don't know if he's got, he's got a film production company now.
All right, okay.
And I met him and I found him a fascinating guy because, again, everyone just associates sports people. Yeah, they're not smart or whatever, but his drive and culture and value system, I found really quite inspirational, actually. The way that he documented it, very clear with what he believed in. And he was really articulate how he summarized that. And he's obviously his thick Yorkshire accent or thick accent stacked, absolutely ripped. So he looks like, he'd tear your head off. But just absolutely fascinating guy. So I'm not surprised to hear that, but it's interesting to hear that that was there then when he was heavily involved in playing as well.
It's true. I mean it was probably the one of the best examples of, people talk a lot about culture of an organization or a sports club. I'd say that what I saw then just in my brief time at Leeds Rhinos was probably one of the best examples of that I've ever seen, actually working in the flesh and people living that. And no surprise, obviously, that around that time and then the years following, they just like won multiple league championships and all the cups and everything like this. Like you could just see that that was running through the system, and then it followed over. So a couple of times I went to the medical department there, and seeing them, it was the same thing. It kind of went through the whole way through the club, really, I would say. And people talk about that quite a lot, I think, in sports, but not always actually done on the ground, or when things get tough. But in that environment, you definitely saw it.
Yeah, no, I think it is interesting. And then it's on the counter side, you see the teams that struggle, and it seems like the culture is maybe the issue there. So I think probably in anything outside of sport, everything that's that I find all that stuff really fascinating of having a place that you want to be and you want to support your teammates or whatever that may be. So then what prompted the move to Australia?
Good question. I'm trying to remember why we did that. I think it was just us wanting to, sense of
Sounds good, doesn't
adventures.
it?
Yeah, I can't remember exactly why, but it just seemed like the right thing to do at the time. And like I say, we got married, and then went basically, like we got married in the summer 2011, and then I'd finished my GP training in that summer. And Helen, my wife, is a care of the elderly geriatrics consultant now, and she was, I think, 2 or 3 years left of her training scheme, and so she was able to get an out what they call like an out of program job in Australia in Sydney that counted towards her training. So she was doing like a training post to registrar in Bankstown Hospital in Sydney that counted towards her training, and I got a job in the emergency department in Concord Hospital, which so happened that it was on the same site as the as a kind of offshoot of the AIS. The Australian Institute of Sport had a little tiny, literally porter cabin in the car park of the Concord Emergency Hospital. So same thing, when I was there, I managed to get a little bit of experience just seeing how things were done in Australia, in that environment. And again, just stimulated my interest in it. And I'd actually had actually had a meeting before I went with Phil Batty, who was at the time the Manchester City doctor, and at the time was also the Northwest Sports Medicine Training Program director. So I'd met him before I went and said I was interested in applying for the scheme. But I was going to be in Australia, and I just was wanting to find out if that was possible to apply while I was still abroad. And he was very supportive of that. So when the time came to do the application, again, it's probably the two people I would have huge thanks for in my career, like John Greenwell for the initial experience, and then Phil for this reason, is that I applied for the scheme. And it so happened that the interview was timed on my 30th birthday, when I was on this island called Lord Howe Island in the middle of the Pacific, because we'd finished work. And we ended up trying to do it over what was Skype at the time, like this kind of thing with Teams and Zoom didn't exist. So we tried Skype, but it was in the middle of the Pacific, so there was like zero signal. And then I ended up doing the interview. He had to call on his mobile phone to the like little shack hotel thing that we were staying on. And then we did the interview over the phone, which again, like I feel bad saying it now, because yeah, I don't think you'd be able to get away with that now. But even it was, back in 2011, 2012, the specialty was still developing, and we basically did the interview via telephone and managed to get through somehow and get on the training scheme. So same thing, like Phil Battaglia, a huge amount of debt of gratitude too for that, and being flexible and understanding the situation at the time.
And so who else was on the training scheme, and what was that structure like? When did you do that, as soon as you got back to England?
Yeah, I got back and then went on to the Liverpool training scheme. So Nigel Jones was my education supervisor and was running the kind of Liverpool section of the scheme. So same thing, has always been a mentor to me, and someone I've really looked up to. And there was another trainee, Kieran Cosgrave, who's gone on to now be doctor for Ireland RFU and British and Irish Lions. He was a couple of years ahead of me. John Power, who's now a Liverpool doctor, I remember was trainee in Leeds. And there's a lot of other peers who I'm working with now, like Clint Jones, Rebecca Robinson, Andrew Hogg, all of whom we've stayed in touch with. So it's been nice to actually have a group of us all within the same, like, 2 or 3, 4 years as a peer group going through the training scheme, that have then gone on to develop and stay in touch actually as we've developed with our careers. So I look back really fondly on that. It was a really good, really, really good experience. And I remember from the word go thinking that it was something that, I thought, right, I've definitely found what I want to do, right decision. Because my dad, being honest, like, my dad, obviously he was still working as a GP at the time, and I'd finished as a GP, qualified as a GP, and I said to him, I'm going to go and do this 4-year sports and exercise medicine training scheme. And he was pretty open, and still is. We laugh about it now. He was like, you're absolutely barking mad. You're going off to do a training scheme and you haven't got, like, there's no guaranteed jobs. It's a tiny specialty. You could get a job for life as a GP. And I was just, yeah, said, I don't think it's the right thing for me. So yeah, we laugh about it now. He kind of says, probably made the right decision.
And then, so what was your role, or what were the roles that you were doing whilst you were doing your on the training scheme?
So yeah, we did a, I mean, standard, fairly standard rotation of different things, like public health placement in Liverpool, general practice again, and then rotated through different departments: orthopedics, rheumatology, emergency medicine for the first couple of years, to give you, like, a basic grounding in core skills, I would say. And the last couple of years tends to get more experience in sports medicine. So again, I was pretty lucky. Like, I remember taking a call from Nigel about 18 months, 2 years out from finishing my training, and he said an opportunity had come up to work at the what was then the English Institute of Sport, in a supervised role of doing the team doctor role for the British Paralympic swimming team. And so I came over here and met Dave Jones, who was the lead doctor at the time, and started doing this placement. So it was a really unbelievable opportunity, which I didn't fully kind of realize at the time, but they had me doing the team doctor role with Paralympic swimming team. Dave was my supervisor, so it was a similar kind of role in a way to with Leeds and John, is that he had, but I would say much closer supervision as to what I was doing, just as the caliber of the athletes or the kind of situation it was. But yeah, it was great learning opportunity. So then did that with the para swimming team throughout the rest of my training scheme. So I was based at the institute here, like, I think 3 days a week or so. And then towards the end of the training scheme, so I finished it August 2016, so January 2016. At the time, I'd been seeing a few England netball athletes in the multi-sport clinic, and they just didn't have a doctor at the time. And so I remember asking the performance director, Sarah Symington, at the time, and it was Tracy Neville who was the head coach, was there a doctor there with a team who I could hand information over to about these athletes? And they said, there's no one there. And it's just so happened, again, the way that these things progress, is that I then started doing their team doctor role for England netball as a registrar and a supervised role. And then when I came to qualify as a consultant in August of 2016, I then went, one day was a registrar, and then the next day on a sports physician consultant contract doing both of those roles. So it's one of those things that just seemed to migrate. Great experience, like, really great experience.
And so have you been involved in AIS UK Sports Institute since then?
Yeah, so it's been since registrar since 2014 to 2016, and then since 2016 onwards. So initially with Paralympic swimming and England netball, and then went to Rio Paralympics, and then shortly after that, and again a real learning opportunity for me and development opportunity, but I was offered a job with Everton Football Club as their one of their team doctors. And at the time, it just seemed like too good an opportunity to pass over. So I ended up stopping doing the Paralympic swimming job and then took on doing the Everton role 2 days a week alongside a few other doctors, working with a really great physiotherapist who was the head of medicine at the time called Matt Connery, who's now at Manchester City. And Matt was fantastic and, you know, brought me into the club and we had kind of plans to be doing some work together. But unfortunately, he moved on. And then quite quickly after that, I was kind of, you know, they wanted to revamp the whole medical department and I was like last in, first out. So left after a few months, which at the time I remember feeling pretty, you know, sad about because, you know, you had a job that was perceived to be quite high profile and then it just didn't work out. And many different things went on during that few months there that I learned a lot from that wasn't a great experience, but, you know, really helped with my development and clarify where I wanted to be working, you know, in my sports medicine career. So then after that went down the route of, you know, more NHS and sticking with the institute after that, I would say.
So I'm an Everton fan, by the way, so I know Matt really well.
Matt's Matt's a really great guy.
No, he's a really good guy, so you've done stuff with him at Everton and at Man City. But like, what was it like then for you? So you enjoyed it there and you obviously that status, Premier League's big. What was it in particular that you enjoyed having alongside the other work that you were doing, being in the Premier League team?
It was an insight into the level of deep, I think probably an insight in that few months into the level of detail you could go to when you had financial support and also people, the number of people, because there was a huge number of people who worked there, all of whom were really heavily motivated to do the best for the team. And there was a huge amount of money available, I would say, because it was in that era where they just had the new owners. And so it was in the summer where Wayne Rooney was signed, Michael Keane and others for quite a lot of money. And so they had, you know, real huge sense of optimism there at the club, as you probably remember as a fan. Which didn't quite work out. So the positives were there in that, and I was an insight into this because I'd come pretty fresh out of the training scheme and fresh out of working in the institute where, although there is money available from UK Sport, UK Sports Institute, actually the real focus within the institute, I think, and it has always been, is like development of the person, you know, of the practitioner to their absolute utmost, to get the most out of the practitioner you possibly can do, who then in turn will then try and get the most out of the athlete that they can do. And although we've got good financial resources and good facilities, you know, it's not that it's swarming with money or swarming with loads and loads of people with a huge amount of time in your hands. Like everyone is absolutely, you know, full on it and on the limit, I would say, in this environment. So it was different contrasting things. So I saw that as a positive, like, wow, look at all these opportunities. But actually, that also works as a negative as well, because there's lots and lots of people there. And it was going back to the contrast with Leeds Rhinos. Like, if you don't have a good, you know, strategy and culture as a sports organisation as a whole, then things just don't work, basically. And that's what I saw at that time. Without going into too much detail, that was certainly that. And in all fairness, you know, the differences between, if we compare those situations like Leeds Rhinos and what was going on there and the success they had versus, you know, that football club and what's happening at the moment, you can kind of see the comparison, basically, without going into details.
That's one of the things that kind of did come to mind there, and, you know, same, you know, some other teams as well. But what, in terms of Matt Connery then, what was it in particular that you found, that you spoke really highly of him there? What was it that he did that was so helpful for you?
I would say the thing that jumps to my mind is that he cared about you as an individual. Was the thing that, again, didn't necessarily see that. Sometimes don't see that in sports in general. I think that's probably true in football. That's quite a kind of sweeping statement. But I think sometimes professional sport can be that way a bit more. But yeah, that's my main memory of working with Matt, even just over a short period of time, is that it was obvious that he cared about the people who he worked with. And he was, Matt, you know, leading that department, but genuine, just like care about individuals and also about the players and wanting the best for the team. And it was quite a difficult, you know, scenario, quite a lot of stress going on at the time for him personally as well, I think, just with changing in roles. But still, you know, was very consistent with his behaviours and, you know, consistent with the way you would talk to people and act towards people, that you could just see fundamentally was a good person and, you know, care deeply about other people, I think, and their development. So, and, you know, when I've, I know a few doctors who work with him at Man City and everyone says the same thing about him. So, yeah, I think that's, you know, it's a good sign of character, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. No, I'm sure I'd be very happy to hear that feedback. And then, so after you'd left Everton then, how did you feel your time that had been left from that?
So around the time I picked up work, again, it worked out nicely that there was an opportunity at Ormskirk, Southport and Ormskirk NHS Trust with Nigel Jones, who had then taken on the business of delivering medical service for as a doctor within their musculoskeletal clinic, joint health department there. So I've started working there in the NHS a couple of days a week. Alongside other, there was a couple of other doctors during that time. So Clint Gomes, who's a sports physician with British Cycling with the Institute, was there at the time. Sarah Lindsay, Chris Garnett latterly as well. So there was a few of us working there, providing sports and exercise medicine, you know, consultant services, working alongside the physio team there. And that's where I've stayed to this day, you know, like years later. And it's been great because we went in there at the start when they were redeveloping that service. And so we've been able to work alongside them to do lots of really great work, I think, you know, particularly around, you know, multidisciplinary team working, education, you know, like staff development. It's been really good place to work. So I picked that up a couple of days a week after stopping the Everton job, carried on the netball role. And then started doing a little bit, just started to dabble in a bit of private practice. So John Rogers and Leon Creaney were working at the time at the Bupa Musculoskeletal Clinic in the middle of Manchester. And there was an opportunity to join them half a day a week. So it seemed like a pretty good controlled way of starting to get a bit of experience in the private world. So I went and joined them in that clinic. And we worked together for a bit. And again, that's been instrumental in setting up, again, a multidisciplinary team approach to discussing cases. And that's been hugely valuable for me as I've developed my career of working alongside John and Leon in particular, you know, discussing problem cases. And we still run a multidisciplinary team meeting to this day every single week. Now do it all team with one of the radiologists there. And that's been, you know, what, seven or eight years still going on. So that started up around that time.
Mm. And yeah, so how did our team come about?
Our team was, it was after, I joined Bupa, just did my private practice there, and John left, and then Leon also left as well. And they'd been there 7 to 10 years probably, I think, doing the practice there, and then felt it was the right time for them to move on to other sites. So I stayed with Bupa for a while, and then it was probably last summer where I got to the point where I wanted to. It was more about self-development, I think, like I'd got to the stage where I felt that I wanted to continue to develop my own clinical practice, clinical skills. I really value working alongside other people, and I wanted to test myself a little bit of working alongside who I perceived to be the best and learn from them. And in my own mind, that was provided by the staff who work at the All Team Centre. So, I joined them August last year as an affiliate and just do a clinic a week there, adding an extra clinic in the start of 2024. But same thing, yeah, I hugely value working alongside others and learning from other people, I think. And it's been, yeah, has been that way at that place. So we do, you know, weekly MDT with John Leon, one of the radiologists. I'm part of the spinal multidisciplinary team meeting as well every other week. Then there's the other consultants there are just, I would say I've found them very approachable and available to discuss problem cases. People are willing to help each other out, which is just a great place to work, I would say.
Mm. And so one of those MDT meetings, like, what's like the agenda for those then, like in a snapshot?
In a snapshot, so the two ones, the one we do on a Thursday is, you know, if you're going to give it a title, sports medicine, sports injury, MDT, we tend to bring problem cases there. So there might be, you know, a case you've come across and you just can't figure out what's going on with the patient. You want a second or third opinion. You know, have you ever seen this before? Have you found anything that's worked? You know, you might be discussing treatments that are perhaps not totally evidence-based, but you want the experience of others to say, has that worked, you know, in like an N equals one scenario. So it can be those type of situations. And the other one, because we've got Andy Dunn, who is the radiologist who does the meeting, like hugely experienced and you know, incredible radiologist. And actually what I've found is very often, you know, if you look at radiology and imaging, you're relying on me looking at the images, right? So, and I'm not a trained radiologist, but I'll look at them just to try and get my own sense of what's happening, and helps with explaining that to the patient. But you're also relying on a written report from a radiologist in time, who just has the context of what you're written in that little box on the request form. So I've actually found discussing cases where it doesn't all seem to add up, and you look at the images again, you know, as a group, have a bit more detail and depth around the case. And it's very, very common, I think, that you find just, you know, even just little subtle changes, or Andy will come up with something different, or some other possibility or an opinion on the images. You know, it's just incredibly common. And I found that, you know, probably 60 to 80% of the time you discuss a case going in with the theory in your mind of X, and you come out actually with challenges saying, actually consider Y or Z. So it's kind of like, it really helps challenge like your bias as a clinician to think you're on the right track, and then things aren't quite working out, and then actually you come out with different opinions to consider. So I find it really useful to make sure you don't go down little rabbit warrens with trying to treat patients, which can often be pretty complex, because by the nature of the patients we see privately, they've often had symptoms for quite a few months, often complex, you know, comorbidities, all have had input from really good therapists, but they just haven't got better. So they're often not like the easy cases, I would say. Yeah,
no, that's really interesting. That's a good insight. Thanks for that. And then in terms of what you see for you in the future then, so you've still got a long career ahead of you. So like what are your plans? Like, what do you have, a mission or philosophy or things that you want to be involved in?
Yeah, I think that, again, good question. I think that's changed over time, you know, as I've developed as a person, what my interests are. I would say if you'd asked me that 2 or 3 years ago, I was really enjoying and thriving being, you know, a team sports physician, of working directly on the with athletes. You know, the role I did with England netball through to the Commonwealth Games last year, the role previously British Para Swimming. Like I really enjoyed like the close interaction with athletes and the staff and the team. And I'd say just probably in the last like 12 to 18 months, my focus has been much more on supporting, enabling, developing, mentoring others. Like I get a huge amount of satisfaction out of that side of things. So if I give you examples, like I'm currently training program director for Northwest, for the trainees in the Northwest. We've got 5 trainees who are, I've really been enjoying that role. It's only a small part of the week. The sports medicine lead role I do for the Institute now, so that involves providing technical leadership for 12 different doctors. So really kind of like high level doctors who are working with different national governing bodies within the UK. So they're already operating at a really, really high level, and I kind of see my role there as like supporting and enabling them and helping them to develop to be even better, which is a definite challenge, but one that I really, really enjoy. So I would say that side of things, so a summary is kind of like, you know, enabling others to develop, supporting others would be probably like the focus of my my career and the outlook I have at the moment. Yeah, rather than like necessarily like bang on the front line team care. I get that a bit through doing my my role with the EF cycling team. So I cover races with them, probably 40 to 50 days a year. So I work alongside John Greenwell still now. Actually, he's the head doctor there. So that gives me the a nice escape to do like, you know, proper frontline team sports physician care. But yeah, and I would say the kind of other bit is my main focus is the work at the Institute now.
And then, so what would you say then for those people that you're trying to mentor, like what are the non-clinical skills that you think are really critical or that they should be aware of to thrive?
I would say in a sports setting, then number one is the communication side of things to people, everyone else who looks after the athlete. And that's particularly true in the Institute setting. So we would have an athlete come to us from a sport. You may not know much about that sport whatsoever, you know, mogul skiing, gymnastics, for example. And you see this athlete sat here in the clinic with a health problem. And you can do that pretty well, I think, you know, like we've been trained, you know, hopefully at this level, you can actually practice the medicine pretty well, you know, of diagnosing an injury, ordering a scan, interpreting the scan correctly. But actually, the real important bit, I think, that takes people to the next level is the ability to communicate that to the athlete effectively. But really importantly, making sure that everyone in their support team is aware of that, you know, a discussion and involved in a discussion about how best to care for that athlete. So that's what I often talk when the registrars come through the institute here, is they say to me, like, the thing that is quite different is that focus on making sure that with consent, of course, that the decision making and care of the athlete is shared throughout the multidisciplinary team, rather than it just be a hierarchical, I'm the doctor, I'm making the decision, the decision is X, and then just, you know, end at that point. Like, you often find you see the athlete for 20, 30 minutes, but then after that, it's often 20, 30 minutes more on a Teams call or a phone call or an email to actually hand back over and making sure that everyone is on the same page. So then the athlete is getting the same consistent message all the way across. So I'd say that's probably the thing that's most vital. Like, whenever we come across any conflicts or difficulties in the doctors that I technically lead or outside of the institute work who I help mentor, it's hardly ever related to, like, medical skills, like, almost never. It's almost always related to interpersonal difficulties and communication challenges, conflicts that arise that way. And I see that being the real thing that makes people who are, everyone's good at their job, but making people, like, excellent at their job. I think that's the bit that to absolutely nail. So yeah, that's the area I kind of tend to focus on.
Yeah, no, that's definitely good advice. And then in terms of giving advice for people that are looking to get into sports medicine, whether it's a doctor or a physio or that, like, what would your advice be for people at university or considering the profession?
I would probably go the reverse and say, don't do it too soon. Because the tendency now, from what I speak to, you know, have emails off people, because my email is available online on the training program director site, or at conferences. Like, I have people who are, you know, doing A levels or early years medical school who are asking the exact same question. And I say to them, like, actually just enjoy the journey, you know, because my story is that way, is that if you'd asked me if I was, like, first, second, third year med school, what I would be doing, it'd be completely different. You know, you just learn and develop as your experience grows. So I think, fine if you're interested in it, but don't kind of, like, consume your whole life and your whole career thinking that's the way you're going to go when you're, like, A levels medical student, even, like, as the first 1 or 2 years out of medical school as a doctor. So yeah, I tend to try and say that it's, like, enjoy the journey, enjoy the experience, learn as broad as you possibly can rather than going too narrow too early, because you know that life and situations change. I probably tend to tell people that, which is somewhat different to what they're wanting to hear sometimes. They want me to kind of tell them on a menu as to how to get onto the training scheme or whatever, but I tend to go at a different approach and say, like, the real importance is getting a broad basis experience and skills of the doctor as a person, and then after that specialize. So
yeah, well, I think there's also this in society and the world, there's so much stuff, social media, do this, quick win, pathways, yeah, books, professional development, all of these things, which I love, but it also does have that sort of subliminal pressure that you need to be doing stuff, you've got to be on all the time, whereas, yeah, and then navigating your own way can also be a really good way to just figure out actually what you enjoy doing.
It's true, and I would say, like, the people who have had that, been able to say stop and slow down to me, because I'm quite a motivated person, I'm kind of like that, I want to try and develop myself. I remember Nigel telling me this when I was a sports medicine registrar, and I was asking him probably all the time, can I do this, can I do this, can I do this, and he just said to me, like, you know, put the brakes on a bit, you know, the key thing is getting the core basic knowledge and skills nailed, and then after that you can start to develop, like, the finer things. And that's something that I say the same thing to the people I, you know, do the same, like, technical lead registrar stuff for nowadays. And then Anita Biswas, who's head of sports medicine, same thing here, like, I'm really keen to develop my role at the institute and develop myself in the institute role, and you know, I really value her experience and advice, because she's the same, so sometimes saying, you know, just hold on a bit, focus on this. And actually it's good advice to have someone in your life who you can you trust, who can tell you that type of thing, rather than just going off and always having to work at 100 miles an hour. I think
definitely. Cool. I did one of these with Andy Franklin Miller, and he said about the one thing, I don't know if you've read that book, but it was really good. And it was just basically just trying to nail, get specialising in one particular thing or really focusing. I'll send you my notes on it because I found it quite useful and it was quite an interesting insight from him. Do you do any professional development books yourself?
Yeah, I read quite a lot. Listen to a lot of podcasts. I tend to like those type of things, like reading factual type self-development things. Sometimes it can be a bit dry, but I like those.
Which would you recommend?
I mean, it depends on what I'm doing. I sometimes tend to flip between reading a book and then picking it back up again 3 or 4 years later when I'm doing something in my life that is relevant to that. So one that I remember reading, 4 or 5 years ago, was the Made to Stick book by the Heath brothers. And so I've just started reading that a little bit more recently. Like, we're doing a lot of work in the Institute at the moment around athlete health, like promotion of like positive health behaviours through a lens looking at illness prevention over the winter time and then at the games next year. And so we're developing a lot of like athlete focused educational material, and we're trying to make the messages there, as you know, basically what they say, sticky as possible, so it sticks in the athlete's mind and they do something. And so I started reading that again, so it's actually pretty good. It gives a nice framework for how to develop these like educational things and presentations as well to try and stick and stay in people's minds. So that's something I'd probably recommend if anyone's looking at that side of things.
Yeah, very good. Brilliant. Good. Well, I know you've got your own podcast coming up soon with some of the UK Sports Institute. So good luck with that.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't call it a podcast. It's more just an interview. That it's the same thing as helping, you know, the staff who are going to or involved at the games next year. Like, we've got a lot of experience within the Institute, and we've got a real good structure behind helping the staff who work for us prepare for major games, because it can be, you know, both emotive, stressful, full-on experience. And so we've got real strong belief that actually helping people to prepare before, during, and then particularly afterwards, it's like a bit of a decompression, is critically important. We're doing a little interview with Pippa and Kate and Kate, who I work alongside, who've got, you know, lots and lots of experience of going to multiple Olympic and Paralympic games, which will hopefully be useful for the staff. So let's have a listen to.
Great. No, sounds good to know. Well, Jim, appreciate you fitting me into your busy schedule, and I look forward to seeing you in Manchester at some point in the near future.
Yeah, thanks for the invite as well. I enjoyed that.
No problem. Cheers. Thanks, Jim.